Welcome to History Counts. History provides the roadmap to the future. If you want to know where you're going, you have to understand where you've been. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. For centuries, the Central Asian nation of Afghanistan has been the target of invasion by ambitious empires. Why do great powers find it so important to attempt to conquer this remote and poor country? And what has been the fate of the invading armies? For the answers to these questions, please stay tuned for this edition of History Counts, Afghanistan, Graveyard of Empires. Welcome back to History Counts. This is your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. In today's program, we're going to focus on the history of Afghanistan, a seemingly remote nation that has become the focus of United States foreign policy. To help us understand this pivotal country, we're very fortunate to have with us today military historian Stephen Tanner, author of Afghanistan, A Military History. Mr. Tanner, thank you very much for joining us today on History Counts.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Could you please help us locate Afghanistan on the map?
You know, some say its geography is both a blessing and a curse. It's basically in the southern part of Central Asia, a landlocked country just to the left of India and Pakistan and just to the right of Iran and Iraq and just south of the Central Asian steppes, former Soviet republics.
Are the Afghans a single ethnic group?
No, that's part of the problem of the country. There's basically four major groups there. The dominant one is the Pashtun tribal group, which is in fact the world's largest remaining tribal-based society. They're basically in the east and the south of the country and also in Pakistan. The country is split by the Hindu Kush Mountains, and within the Hindu Kush, there's a group called the Hazaras, who are descended from the Mongols, who once invaded Afghanistan. And north of the Hindu Kush, you have the Uzbeks, Tajiks, and Turkmen.
So no one group has a majority?
The Pashtuns are dominant. They've got about 40% of the population in Afghanistan. But a key is that even more Pashtuns live on the Pakistan side of the border. And since the border is basically invisible anyway, the Pashtuns do tend to dominate as far as population.
This was due to the Sir Mortimer Durrand's line in 1893?
Yeah, the British surveyor who drew the border. And no one could really locate it actually on the ground. He just sort of went on a bird-watching trip through the mountains, planting stakes here and there, just so they can draw a map.
And it bisects the Pashtun territory?
Right. In fact, that was part of his task, to sort of weaken the Pashtuns by putting half of them on the Afghan side and half of them on the Pakistan side, so that neither could dominate either country.
So the Afghan society is basically tribally organized?
Well, the Pashtuns are. The Tajiks and the Uzbeks, they tend to be a bit more sophisticated, a little bit more urbanized, higher literacy rate and everything else. Pashtuns are very largely rural, herdsmen, farmers, that sort of thing, and the literacy rate is very low.
You describe the bulk of Afghanistan's land as, quote, unrelentingly harsh. Could you please talk about the country's geography?
A large portion of it just inclines vertical. Mountains in the center of it and the east of it. Where it's not mountains, it's very often desert.
Where are the cities located?
There's one major highway in the entire country called the Ring Road. Basically makes a circle. And north, east, west, and south of the Hindu Kush are the major cities. And they're all tied together by a highway. But outside of these major urban centers, there's very little road network at all.
Do the cities tend to be in the fertile valleys?
Exactly. And you might say they're right along the invasion routes also. So anytime someone invades Afghanistan, the first thing they do is take the cities, which is relatively easy. The countryside is the major problem.
Well, you're right that Afghanistan is a relatively easy country to invade, but a difficult one to occupy. Why is that?
Well, it's just because of the social structure of the country. Being very largely a tribal-based society and with separate ethnic groups that are quite often at each other's throats, it's never had that secure of a government, much less a standing army. So it's not the type of society that can have a standing army to defend its borders. Just about any country could break into there. But once you're in, that's the problem, because the Afghans don't tolerate occupation. It's not only hard to occupy, it's also hard to govern from the capital, Kabul, because of the lack of road network, a self-reliant population that's usually not used to seeing government officials at all, much less being taxed or having obligations. It's just very difficult for a poor government in Kabul to exert authority over its people. You know, they're not only independent from the government, they're independent from each other. It's said that someone could grow up in one valley and never meet the tribe that lives in the next valley. And when they do meet, they basically fight.
So the only thing that seems to bring them together is an outside threat.
That's one thing that seems to bring them together. They can fight with each other century after century, but if a foreign intruder steps in, then suddenly they have a miraculous way of uniting.
Now, in your book, you recount many foreign intruders over the centuries, and one of the earliest invasions of Afghanistan that you describe was that of Alexander the Great in 329 BC.
Yeah.
Now, Alexander the Great was from Macedonia, which is north of Greece. What was he doing so far east as Afghanistan?
He was trying to find the end of the world, which the ancient Greeks thought was basically located around the Indus River. He wanted to exceed all other conquerors in the scope of his achievements. After conquering the Persian Empire, he just kept going east in order to find what the Greeks called ocean, meaning the end of the world. And so he found himself in Afghanistan and had a very harrowing experience.
So he was en route to India.
Right.
So although the invasion began fairly well, I understand, it didn't prove to be an easy occupation. Could you talk about that?
Well, like everyone else, he had no trouble getting into the country, but once he got there, he had terrible problems with the climate. The territory was barely mapped. He didn't know what he was getting into.
Could you talk about his march through the Hindu Kush?
Yeah, he tried it in spring, which normally wouldn't have been such a bad time. And all we can think is that he got hit by an unseasonable winter storm up there. And his army suffered terrible casualties from frostbite, and they just barely stumbled out of the Hindu Kush alive.
But if that wasn't bad enough, then he had a bad experience in the Afghan desert.
Exactly. After getting out of the Hindu Kush with half his army frostbitten, then he found himself in a desert, and then his men began dying of heat stroke. He finally reached the Oxus River, and his men, many of them, just started drinking water like crazy, and one of the ancient historians said he lost more men there than in any battle.
He also had a different type of warfare that he had to face. You say that when he was in pitched battles against the Persians, his Macedonian phalanx was very successful, but it wasn't the same story when he had to deal with the hit-and-run tactics of the nomads of Afghanistan.
Yeah, we can call that the third of his travails in Afghanistan. Aside from freezing in the mountains and then burning in the desert, suddenly he met these horse warriors of the steppe, which they're not far off from comparison to the Indian tribes of the American West in their tactics, except they were more sophisticated. You know, they had bronze armor and advanced degree of archery. But he had primarily a foot army, and here he is with these mounted armies that basically he just chased ragged in the territory north of Afghanistan for 2 years.
He finally moves on to India. What's the condition of his army when he advances east to India?
I think it was a great deal of relief just to get out of Afghanistan.
Well, as Alexander's invasion of Afghanistan suggests, Afghanistan is not necessarily sought by invaders for its intrinsic resources, but because of its location, and in Alexander's case, because it was en route to India.
Exactly.
Could you talk about, for example, the Silk Road and how that relates to Afghanistan?
Afghanistan, standing between several great empires, the Indian Empire, the Persian Empire, you can even throw in the Western empires of Egypt, Greece, and Rome, China. At the time when all trade had to occur by land, or most of it, was a vital route connecting all these various empires. So at one time in the early medieval period, Afghanistan had excellent cities and a thriving economy.
So while this brought wealth to Afghanistan's cities, the geographic location of Afghanistan also made it vulnerable to the invasions from the barbarian steppe warriors from the north, like the Huns and the Mongols.
Well, exactly. It was basically the first stop for the great migrations of horse warriors from the north. The White Huns who came down, and they were basically trying to get to India, the Parthians who conquered Persia, and then they came to Afghanistan. And finally, the most terrible of them all, the Mongols, who basically just one gigantic raid. They were bent on nothing but destruction, really. They didn't want to colonize. They didn't want to occupy. They were basically just marauders, and they just laid waste the place.
This is in the 13th century. You say the Mongol invasion really had a long-term effect on the character of Afghanistan.
Yeah, some people call it the medieval equivalent of an atom bomb. Because they didn't want to use or exploit the country, they just wanted to plunder it, the death and destruction that they wielded was just enormous. And along the Helmand River, south of the Hindu Kush, there used to be a pretty thriving farming civilization there, and the Mongols just wiped it out. They filled in the irrigation ditches. They killed a large part of the population, chased much of the rest of it away. The people basically took to the hills, where many of them have been ever since. And so that whole civilization has really never recovered.
So it really shifted the weight of Afghanistan from possibly an urban society to warrior tribes in the hills.
I think it had as good of a chance as any country at having an established civilization. You know, not unlike Iran has today, but it just was ravaged so many times by cross currents of invading armies that the character of the people, who, and they were warlike enough themselves, but they just became very remote from any vulnerable sedentary communities.
Isolation seems to be one of the fundamental characteristics of Afghanistan, and this was increased when the Silk Road went out of use due to the rise of the maritime powers.
Exactly. The whole key about Afghanistan was when commerce had to take place by land, but basically when sea power came into its own, suddenly someone could reach India without even having to step foot on Afghanistan soil. So Afghanistan transitioned over the course of a couple hundred years, not into a vital crossroads, but instead into a vacuum that could be easily avoided.
You mentioned the development of gunpowder. You note that that innovation was really a huge advantage to this warrior culture. It put the Afghan warrior on an equal footing with other armies.
Well, it's like that old quote, God didn't make all men equal, Colonel Colt did. That applied to the Afghans because they used to be at the mercy of these, say an army with beautiful armor, the best horse and bow, and poor Afghans had none of that. But the invention of the rifle just leveled the playing field.
Now, Afghanistan doesn't emerge as a nation until the 1700s with Ahmad Khan. Did the monarch establish much of a central government?
No, he didn't really. He was rich enough, but it was a government that lived on plunder rather than taxation. So the social organization remained tribally based. And the ruler of Afghanistan, basically, his system was just to form tribal alliances or ethnic group alliances. And he would reward the people just through plundering their neighbors, primarily in India.
I see. So the tribes would come together with him for a war purpose, but they wouldn't necessarily remain together as a unified country.
Exactly. It would be a matter of, okay, spring's arrived, it's time to go sack Lahore again. So everyone would come together. They would go home rich with, all the plunder they could gather. But as far as rule of law and social network or building infrastructure, the Afghan government was not very skilled at that.
Now, in the 19th century, Afghanistan's geographic position made it an important stage in the so-called Great Game. What was the Great Game and how was Afghanistan involved?
The Great Game was basically a contest for India, which after North America slipped from colonial control, India became the biggest colonial prize in the world, and the British got there first and were able to establish rule there. But Russia was also enlarging under the Tsars, and Russia had a very easy direct route. They were much closer to India, and the only thing standing between Russia and India at that time was Afghanistan. So the British were always nervous to the point of paranoia that Russian armies had come marching through Afghanistan. The thing is, it was all a false alarm, because at that time they needed to conquer those arid Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan. They were expanding southward. But a Russian army got caught in a horrible snowstorm. It was decimated, and it had to retreat. But the British were so alarmed about it, and they didn't hear about the retreat, so they moved their own army into Afghanistan.
This is in 1839 they invade?
Yeah.
And they have pretty good luck at first?
Yeah, like everyone else, it was sort of a walkover invasion. They went to Kandahar first, then they conquered Ghazni, where they had a pretty tough battle, and then they basically just walked into Kabul.
And they install a new king, a Shah Shuja?
Yeah. The other king, Dost Muhammad, who they were afraid was collaborating with the Russians, he took to the hills. So the British had a very easy occupation of Kabul. They had some relative of Dost Muhammad named Shah Shuja, who they put in as their puppet.
And the Brits actually collect taxes for the Afghan government and become paymasters for the army. And you're right, I think most interestingly, that they put the tribal chiefs of eastern Afghanistan on their payroll. Why did they do that?
Well, it was very important to keep open the passes, famous Khyber Pass and the Bolan Pass. Eastern Afghanistan is so mountainous along its border with today's Pakistan, which then was part of India, that there's only a very few access routes to getting supplies and reinforcements, and these routes were all controlled by local tribes. So the British very wisely just put these tribal leaders on subsidies, they called them, basically bribes to keep the passes open.
So the British convoys from India could get into Afghanistan?
Exactly.
Now, could you talk about William McNaughton's 1841 meeting with the tribal chiefs of the East and when he announced their pay cut?
Well, McNaughton was under a lot of pressure from the government that the Afghan venture was just too expensive. They'd been in there 2 years. There were very few pitched battles at that time, but it was costing a heck of a lot of money to sustain the army there. So he was under a lot of pressure to cut expenses. And he was sort of contemptuous of the Afghan people. He considered them a very primitive society. So he got these tribal chiefs together and said, look, we're going to cut your subsidies. We can't afford this. And if need be, we'll just force open the passes. And they sat there with their arms folded, just nodded, went back, and then they immediately plundered the next British convoy that came through.
They also attacked the diplomatic office in Kabul, and killing its residents.
The British political agent, Alexander Burns, there was an uprising in Kabul, and they killed him and his brother and his entire staff. But when they killed the political agent, they realized, oh, yeah, these guys are as vulnerable as anybody. The British aren't as strong as we thought. And it was like a match that just set off a wildfire, and suddenly large parts of the country rose in rebellion, and the entire British army in Kabul found itself surrounded and penned into its encampment.
Could you talk about the truce that the British army made in January 1842 and its evacuation?
Winter had come. The army was beginning to run out of food. It was surrounded. Opposition only seemed to be growing. So McNaughton made a deal that, or actually McNaughton didn't. He was murdered. He had a meeting with the Afghans and they killed him. But his successors negotiated free passage out of the country, said, look, just let us leave. We'll go back to India and call bygones be bygones.
This was 16,500 people?
Yeah, about 4,500 of them were soldiers. But the British had also brought around 1,000 civilians, a lot of Indian servants, officers' wives. It was just an enormous column of British and Indians that in January 42 started an 80-mile trek back toward the Khyber Pass to try to get back to India. Unfortunately, the Afghan tribes who were holding that pass attacked them all along the way, and the entire force was wiped out.
Who was William Bryden?
Well, he was the only survivor. A few people were captured and held hostage, primarily British officers, but of the 16,000 other people, they were just massacred in the passes over the course of about a week or 10 days. And the British post in Jalalabad, one day they saw one wounded guy on a wounded horse just stumbling out of the mountains, and it was Dr. Bryden. He was the only guy who got away from the column.
Now, the British then form something called an army of retribution and come back?
Which was a very risky thing for them because they weren't sure whether they could win in Afghanistan or not after the disaster that hit the army in Kabul. But in order to restore their prestige, they had to retaliate. And fortunately, they were able to get back to Kabul and defeat the Afghan army. And then they immediately vacated again.
Then years go by and they fight a second Anglo-Afghan war, 1878 to 1881. Are they successful in these wars in establishing compliant leadership in Afghanistan, and to what extent do they actually control the country?
The second war began pretty much exactly for the same reason the first one, paranoia about a Russian encroachment. The British lucked out after the second war because even though militarily they suffered badly, they at least learned the lesson not to stay there and occupy the place for long. They just wanted to get out of there as quickly as they could. And very fortunately, they found a very good emir to put in place. He was considered to be pro-Russian, but they took a gamble on him, and he turned out to be a strong leader. They called him the Iron Emir.
And what's the source of their influence? Did they have him on the British payroll?
Yeah, sure. That's another lesson they learned, to keep these people on their payroll in order to have some compliance with their foreign policy. They didn't want to enforce any kind of social system in Afghanistan. They just wanted Afghanistan in compliance with their foreign policy, which namely meant to keep the Russians out.
So it really wasn't an issue of controlling the life of the tribes or of turning Afghanistan into a little England. It was mainly a question of controlling the foreign policy, ensuring that they weren't too friendly with the Russians so that they could protect British India.
Exactly. As opposed to most British possessions, like in India, they tried to set up a rule of law. They tried to enhance medicine. They built railroads, road network. You know, the British generally tried to develop the countries that they occupied, but in Afghanistan, they weren't, we can't occupy the place. So all they wanted was compliance with the foreign policy.
And you're right that this control by Britain of Afghan's foreign policy lasts until 1919, after World War I.
There was another uprising because they figured the British would be too tired to resist it. But the British responded with air power now, which the Afghans thought barbaric. But they had no way to resist it, so the rebellion ended shortly. But at that time, the Russian Revolution had happened, so the Russian threat seemed to have receded. So the British said, okay, look, you can have your foreign policy back. We're done with you.
Well, turning to more recent history, in 1979, Afghanistan is again invaded, this time by the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
Why was that?
Afghanistan actually had a period of relative tranquility under a king who took office in the early 30s, and he ruled for 40 years, and the country was actually pretty stable. And like every other country in the 60s and 70s, there was a liberal movement in the universities and cities. Again, you know, Afghanistan is not a very literate country, but in Kabul and Herat and other cities, there were colleges and universities, and a leftist tide, the same as in the rest of the world, had this young intelligentsia looking to Marxism or socialism, and these people were able to pull a coup and take over the government. Unfortunately, Afghan society wouldn't tolerate any sort of leftism. They considered it anti-Islamic, so the new communist government immediately found itself under attack. So the Soviet leadership figured, just as they had in Hungary and Czechoslovakia, okay, let's go to the defense of a fellow communist regime. So they invaded Afghanistan in order to restore the leftist government.
And as you mentioned, Islam is a unifying factor in Afghanistan.
It may be the most unifying factor, actually. In fact, during the foreign invasions, the people tend to rally under the banner of Islam rather than under the Afghan flag. I mean, they know or care little about the government in Kabul, but they do know their Quran.
And again, with the Russians, they found it fairly easy to take Kabul and establish a new government, but it was harder to deal with the later resistance.
Exactly. It's cliche to say history repeats itself, but they found themselves in the exact same position the British had. They went in there, took the cities, occupied the place, thought, well, this was easy, and then all of a sudden they realized, holy cow, the strength of this country isn't in the cities at all. It's in the countryside. Just gradually, the countryside starts rising around them, and they start taking more and more casualties, and then suddenly they wake up and find out that they're in a real war.
And these are the Mujahideen?
Exactly, which means soldiers of God. And again, you know, they weren't rallying around the flag in Kabul. They were rallying around Islam.
And they were helped by foreign nations, including Pakistan and the United States?
First, it was mainly Pakistan and Saudi Arabia. Pakistan, for geopolitical reasons, they didn't want a Russian-occupied neighbor, especially since at that time Russia was fairly friendly with India, so Pakistan felt itself being surrounded. And the Saudis, naturally, they're the leaders of Islam, and they poured money into it too. And only gradually the United States realized that, hey, the Soviets are getting bogged down here. They're having their own Vietnam. You know, let's help also.
One of the fallouts of the Pakistan intervention or aid to the Mujahideen was that essentially, you say, Pakistan conceded sovereignty over the northwest frontier to the Mujahideen.
Well, that's the thing. The Soviets were so fearsome, they had so much firepower that the Mujahideen groups couldn't really exist or have their base camps inside Afghanistan. So they moved across the border into Pakistan. And, you know, all the different resistance groups set up bases in Pakistan, which the Soviets, for various political reasons, they were forbidden from attacking in Pakistan.
While the Soviet Union had 85,000 troops in Afghanistan, it's really the 400 helicopters and jets that are the unique aspect of their military effort. Could you talk about the use of air power by the Soviets in Afghanistan?
Well, sure. That was the great solution to the terrain, because land armies just had an awful time attacking the guerrillas or the resistance fighters in the hills. But with a Hind helicopter gunship, you can reach those points, at least in good weather. So it became an utterly fearsome war. And the Soviets, they were pretty brutal about it. They were familiar with people's revolutions themselves. And they realized, we just have to depopulate this place. So they would just carpet bomb villages, try to destroy farms, just wreck whatever infrastructure they could find in what's been termed a forced migration. And a million or two refugees just headed over to Pakistan just to get away from the Soviet firepower. But that was part of the Soviets' intent.
And they also used these airdrops of infantries to cut off the Mujahideen escape routes in mountains.
That was tough fighting because they could deliver commandos into the mountains to try to get the Afghans where they were hiding. But on the other hand, the Afghans are pretty good fighters, and at that point they had nothing to lose. So the Soviets ended up taking a lot of casualties in those attacks.
You say in 1986 the Afghans got the Stinger. What was the significance of that?
Well, for several years they had an awful difficulty countering Soviet air power. The best they could do really was hide from it. And the Reagan administration had a real debate. We had developed a heat-seeking handheld anti-aircraft weapon called the Stinger. And we weren't sure we wanted to give these to fierce Islamic warriors. But finally, the decision was made that these guys can't hold out against the Soviets unless they're able to counter these helicopter gunships. So Reagan administration made the decision to give them the Stingers, and they had an immediate success. Suddenly Soviet air power met a serious challenge.
You note that in contrast to Vietnam, the Afghan resistance was successful even though it was never unified.
The North Vietnamese army was highly organized. It was a modern, well-supplied army with easy supply routes straight from China and stuff. But the Afghan army, as typical throughout Afghan history, they quarreled with themselves as much as with the Soviets, and they had no unified command at any time. But it's just the fierceness of the resistance, the refusal to quit, and just bleeding the Soviets through 1,000 cuts after 8 years. Gorbachev just termed it a bleeding wound, and they just decided to cut their losses. The ironic thing was when the Soviets pulled out, they left a puppet communist regime behind, and that communist puppet regime lasted longer than the Soviet Union did.
When Winston Churchill was a young officer in the British Army, he fought the Pashtuns. Could you please comment on Churchill's statement that in Afghanistan, quote, every man's hand is against the other and all against the strangers?
Yeah, it's a warlike culture. People call the country medieval, and it's not a slur because it's sort of true, because it's been isolated for so many centuries now that the customs of the people have changed really very little from marauding steppe tribes of the medieval period. The literacy rate is still low, the level of technology, the infrastructure, the road network, the schooling, medicine, you name it, the social system. They basically lived the same way as people lived hundreds of years ago, and that's when people had a more warlike culture. Tribe will fight tribe, family will fight family, clan will fight clan, but the only thing that will really bring them together is when a foreigner comes in.
Well, Mr. Tanner, thanks very much for being with us today.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Nice talking to you, Ken.
You're listening to History Counts, and we've been speaking with author Stephen Tanner about his book, Afghanistan, A Military History. This is your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and I'll be right back. As Professor Tanner explained, Afghanistan is sought by great powers not for its inherent wealth, but rather for its geographic position. For Alexander of Macedonia, Afghanistan was a necessary conquest on his way to the end of the known world. For the British, it was necessary to control Afghanistan to ensure the safety of India, the crown jewel of the British Empire. More recently, Afghanistan's location has made it a key theater in the struggle for the vast, untapped oil and natural gas resources lying in the former Soviet republics to its north. In this regard, Afghanistan is of particular importance to the United States. At odds with Iran and Russia, the United States must look to a pipeline through Afghanistan in order to extract these valuable resources. And indeed, prior to the United States' 2001 invasion of Afghanistan, a consortium led by the American oil company Unocal spent several years in unsuccessful negotiations with Afghanistan's Taliban government for the construction of just such a pipeline. History Counts is produced by MDR Productions, Inc., B.J. McDermott Rowe, Technical Director. Please visit us at historycounts.org, where you can listen for free to an archive of our shows, see a schedule of upcoming programs, and sign up for our monthly newsletter and podcasts. Until next time, this is Ken McDermott Rowe for History Counts.